And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name's Ted McIntyre, and this show is for September 18th, 2022. Despite scientists telling us that the planet should be at 350 parts per million, the latest scientific data says we're currently at 415 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the global atmosphere. That's too high. Additionally, there are 2,662 days left until the year 2030, that benchmark that says we need to cut our carbon dioxide emissions in half by that date. Anyhow, the clock keeps ticking. Well, it's fall of 2022, mid-September, and it's likely we'll be hearing some new words this fall. And it seems appropriate to walk through some of what those words are, just to say you heard it first on the Climate Minute. It's been my experience in life. It's not until the 10th or 15th time I hear a term that it finally begins to make sense. So we'll start counting today. So we're going to talk about words. The context for our discussion is a word that we've talked about a lot in other circumstances, and that's the idea of electrification, electrifying everything. So we spent a lot of time thinking about the built environment. So there, I've already thrown three jargon-filled buzzwords at you. But we think about the houses that we live in here in Massachusetts, how much carbon dioxide comes out of the houses that we live in. Well, a fair amount based on burning natural gas and whatnot. So concept of electrifying everything calls for using heat pumps, which are run on electricity, and induction stoves, which are run on electricity, and basically do everything that we currently do with gas, do it with electricity, electrify the house, reduce your carbon dioxide emissions from the built environment. Right? So there you go. That's the context for a new word. And a lot of the nitty-gritty effort to electrify everything comes down to what some people might consider mundane things like building codes. Right? So we've talked about building codes. Building codes are the rules by which you construct buildings, literally. Right? How many lights? How many wall outlets? How many entrances and exits? Where is the fire? I mean, there's all kinds of rules about how you build a house. One of those rules we hope to encourage the electrification of everything inside the house. Right? But that's not the word. The word we want to talk about, first word we want to talk about, we have several words, but the first word we want to talk about is embodied carbon. Embodied carbon, that is, carbon in the body, right? Embodied carbon in the special context of building codes and building stuff, okay? So let's, for a moment, put on the wall that the idea that we want to electrify the building and run it with electricity once it's constructed. But there is a counterpart to this concept of carbon-free housing. And that's the idea that there's a lot of carbon dioxide emissions that happen in making the parts of that go into your house. That is to say, you know, who knows if there's not a gas-driven chainsaw cutting down the wood that's going to go into your house, right? So the carbon dioxide emission from cutting up that wood would be, in a sense, it's sort of an abstract sense, but that's embodied in the material. Now you have to take that into account if you're going to build a house and say there was some carbon dioxide that was released in the construction, the manufacture of the different parts. One of the big places that there's excess carbon, embodied carbon in your house is in the humble concrete foundation. Turns out that there's a lot of carbon dioxide released in the manufacture of Portland cement, which is basically carbon dioxide. Of course, it's not because you're burning things. It's because when you mix all the stuff together to make cement, a whole lot of carbon dioxide comes off. Just that's the chemical process, right? But now, if you're going to build a house and use, say that the house is green and hasn't got any carbon footprint, you have to ask yourself, how much carbon was released in the manufacture of the cement that I made the foundation out of, right? All that stuff starts to add up. You think about it, how much carbon dioxide was emitted in manufacturing the glass. Indeed, how much carbon dioxide is emitted in making the photovoltaic cell that you have, right? Lots of deep questions, but it's those questions are wrapped up in a concept called embodied carbon. How much carbon dioxide was released in the manufacture of the components that go into your house? And there's a formal definition I found online that says that embodied carbon consists of all the greenhouse gas emissions associated with building construction, including those that arise from extracting, transporting, manufacturing, and installing building materials on a site, as well as the operational and end-of-life emissions associated with those materials. The flip side is, at the end, when you tear the house down, can you reuse those things that can you recycle the parts of the house, right? So the reason we talk about embodied carbon is because it is one of the elements of a building code that ought to be included. And we're going to get to a little bit more information about that in a second. But there you got one word, embodied carbon. Okay, you heard it here first. Another word that we'll be talking about this fall is something called a net zero building code. Again, we're still wandering around the concept of how to get carbon dioxide out of our buildings. The net zero building code is also known with another word. It's called a specialized energy code, right? And the specialized energy code is jargon created by the Department of Energy Resources here in Massachusetts to cover this building code. I won't go into why I think they chose a funny name, but specialized energy code, net zero building code. These are new words you should be familiar with. What's the context? Well, in the various climate bills that have been passed in the Massachusetts legislature, there is a directive to the state government to issue a building code that is, quote-unquote, net zero, which essentially means that there should not be any carbon dioxide emissions from the operation or construction of that house. Right? That's what net zero means. And this pertains to a lot of things. It pertains to how houses get built in Massachusetts, and in particular to a whole concept that's revolving around, you may have heard of it, the 10 communities that are trying to volunteer to be the first towns to implement a net zero building code, which essentially bans gas hookups, natural gas hookups, and requires all electrification. It's all very not controversial, but I mean, it's all in play. The DOER, Department of Environmental Resources, is trying to create this specialized energy code, also known as a net zero building code. And they are accepting comments from the public. You can make comments now. Turns out that some of the flaws in the proposed to draft the straw man specialized energy code that DOER has presented could be rectified. And in particular, crazy as it seems, the net zero building code that's currently under consideration allows the use of natural gas, which just seems like a contradiction in terms, but there you go. That's why it's important to call up or to communicate with the DOER if you can, to tell them not to allow any fossil fuel use in a net zero building. Okay. Some of the jargon that the DOER uses is to call it a fossil fuel pathway, in quotation marks, a pathway to build your house. You can build a nice greenhouse by having natural gas, but with all these other things, et cetera, et cetera. Long and short of it is the correct building code, correct kind of building code should not allow new natural gas hookups. Again, dear listener, keep in mind, this is a idealized code for towns that want to adopt it, not being forced, not being like mandated for everyone yet, but it is the leading edge, this building code. And so the true net zero building code, specialized energy code, those are things you might hear mentioned in discussions around climate stuff. That's what the background is. We want to get the fossil fuel pathway, the use of fossil fuel, to be disallowed in what's called anything that's called a net zero building code. We ask that the DOER essentially put back in something they took out, but they put back in rules about embodied carbon in the material that's used in under a net zero building code. Right? We just talked about what embodied carbon means, and we need to begin to grapple with it. And there are proposals floating around that could be included in this net zero specialized code that have to do with embodied carbon and should be in there to reduce the carbon that's embodied in our buildings from the manufacture of the materials used to make the building. Right? Some other things that float around this net zero building code is that the community should be allowed to join anytime. I guess it's a little unclear to me, but there's some arcane restriction on when communities can volunteer to begin using this code. Right? We can't put it off until 2023 or 24. And there's also an idea that the building code, as it's currently proposed, applies to new construction and substantial renovation, in quotation marks. That is to say, if someone in one of these 10 communities wants to do a big upgrade to their building, that upgrade should be required to be net zero, right? And so that then begs this kind of a political question of how do you define substantial? You know, what criteria are used when you revamp your big building to decide whether or not you must get away from fossil fuels? So the one of the ways that the net zero building code could be improved is to expand the range of buildings that are called significant upgrades, so we get more carbon reductions. Okay, so there you go. So far we've got something like two words, maybe two concepts floating around. You've got the embodied carbon concept, which is kind of a vocabulary word, and then you've got the net zero building / specialized energy code. Two words, you know, two ways of naming the same thing, a building code that is supposed to reduce emissions from buildings. What's the third word? Well, there's another word floating around that we want to talk about. This one's actually an acronym. Maybe more precisely a mashup of words. You should know that there's a thing called the New England Power Pool Commission Committee Group. Okay, and that New England Power Pool uses the acronym NEPOOL, and of course it's said, spoken as NEPOOL, NEPOOL. NEPOOL is an interesting beast. It is essentially a consortium of a whole bunch of different organizations that talk to each other, make proposals, think about things. But the reason that they're special is because NEPOOL is an advisor to the people that run the entire New England grid. Okay, so NEPOOL is an advisor to ISO New England. We've talked about ISO. The independent system operator, ISO, that runs the New England grid. Right? One of the ways ISO learns about what people want and takes input is by getting advice from this group of organizations, this committee called NEPOOL, right? Which is supposed to be a stakeholder and advocate group that tells ISO what's best for the advocates, right? And I looked it up on the looked it up online on the website itself, the knee pool website. It says, since 2005, knee pool has served as New England's independent FERC approved, FERC being the Federal Energy Regulatory Committee, FERC, New England's independent FERC approved stakeholder advisory group on all matters relating to the competitive wholesale market rules and transmission tariff design. So there's a whole lot there, right? But ISO is given a mandate by FERC to basically manage the markets for electricity, wholesale electricity, okay, which is a big deal, and how transmission is going to happen. That is to say, power lines and pipelines and stuff. Right? The knee pool, so this little quip goes on to say, the knee pool stakeholder forum is designed to identify areas of consensus and resolve issues where possible while defining, narrowing, and clarifying issues or concerns where consensus is not achieved through the give and take of the knee pool process. That is to say, knee pool has a process of conversation, identifying issues, listening to people, but I mean organizations, stakeholder organizations that want to influence ISO policy. So of course you can imagine some of those stakeholders are the gas companies, right? They're stakeholders, but there's also room there for grassroots organizations to get involved and people who favor greening of the grid. So knee pool is an important committee. It fits into this big infrastructure that manages. This is now like an organizational chart. It's one of the ways the grid policy is determined. It contributes to that discussion, and it is the reason this knee pool is an interesting thing is because as we march forward in the greening of the grid and the everything we do here in Massachusetts, all of a sudden what you bump into or recognize is that a lot of the decision-making happens at ISO. And ISO needs input from green people about what, you know, how many wind turbines to put up, where to put transmission lines, all kinds of stuff like that. So knee pool is an important thing. It's a committee that advises ISO, and there you go. That's your third word for the week, right? So we're back. We've got embodied carbon. We've got net zero building code. We've got knee pool. And it's three things you learned today. Today I learned. A fourth word that we want to touch briefly on is side deal. Okay, so the side, as you may well, if you're a climate person listening to this podcast, you probably know that the Inflation Reduction Act was passed through the agreement of Joe Manchin and Chuck Schumer. And the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, is a good thing. It's a good thing. It's got a lot of bad stuff in it, but I mean, I hope net-net, it's a good thing. However, one of the things that's not so good about it is that in the process of agreeing to the IRA, Manchin and Schumer made what's called a side deal. That is right. It wasn't part of the Inflation Reduction Act, but it was another deal. And the other deal was aimed at, quote-unquote, reforming the permitting process for building new pipelines. Who would have thought that Joe Manchin would be interested in such a thing? Huh? Anyway, the side deal is essentially advertised as a permitting reform process, and it is expected to be attached to one of the big bills that has to pass to keep the government open. We're all familiar now with this sort of, you know, drama at the end of every session where, you know, is the government going to remain open? Is Congress going to pass the money? Round and round and round. Well, what Schumer and Manchin agreed is they would put this side deal onto something that had to pass to keep the government open. And, of course, the side deal that they negotiated It's basically a giveaway to the fossil fuel company. It's still a little murky what's exactly in the package, but it seems like it wants to strip away the environmental impact statement review process, shorten it, cut out the voice of people, grassroots organizers, and stuff like that. Not a good thing. In full disclosure, I think a lot of climate activists are becoming more and more worried about how we're going to build the good infrastructure, that is to say the transmission lines to carry wind energy around the country, stuff like that. So there is a discussion to be had around the permitting process, but suffice it to say that the side deal that Manchin and Schumer have negotiated is not the solution that we would need, right? So there's your fourth word, side deal. Keep your ears open. Let's see what happens. Finally, just an entertaining, this is now a whole bunch of words, but it's an entertaining little discussion from a Physics Today article from 2011, a long time ago. But it was, the article was basically highlighting the differences in the meaning of words used in a scientific setting versus the everyday use, right? And it's a real thing. And as sophisticated climate hawks, it's important to know the meaning that scientists attach to words when that's distinct from the meaning that everyday language uses. Right? So what I'm going to do is step through this list. I'll try and find the link to the October 2011 Physics Today, but you can probably look it up yourself. Right? So let me just walk through this list. There's what, 15 words. Scientists sometimes say enhance. So the enhanced greenhouse effect, right? The public meaning, what most people think when they hear the word enhance, they think, oh, it's an improvement, right? Enhance, for most people, says improvement. Well, scientifically, enhance means to intensify, right? To increase something. It's not to make it better, it's just to make it more intense. So that's why enhanced greenhouse means more intense greenhouse effects, not a better greenhouse effect. Oftentimes you hear the word aerosol in climate discussions. Most people, when they hear aerosol, think of the stuff that's in a spray can, right? You have an aerosol spray can, at least your mother did when she sprayed her hair, had her hairspray, right, and put on underarm deodorant or something, right? Aerosols, publicly, most people think of spray cans, but scientists think an aerosol, when they say an aerosol, they mean tiny, tiny, tiny little particles that can float in the air. Microscopically small, so small they float around, and they have lots of good and bad effects, right? Not the least of which being they reflect sunlight, and so they have an essentially a cooling effect. And you get those aerosols when you drive your car around, and little tiny particles of soot come out of your tailpipe and float up into the air. Right? That's aerosol. Another word, a positive trend, right? A positive trend, generally speaking, is most people think it's a good trend, right? Something better is happening. Whereas for scientists, when they say a positive trend, it generally means upward, increasing in the value. Temperature is going up. A positive trend of temperatures rising, right? It's not a good thing. It's just an upward trend. Another word is positive feedback. This one really people get mixed up. If you get positive feedback, generally you think you're being praised, right? If you get your boss gives you positive feedback, typically she is saying you did a good job, atta girl, do it again, keep going, right? That's positive feedback. In scientific terms, positive feedback is what amounts to a vicious cycle. It's a self-reinforcing cycle that the thing that happens causes more of the same thing to happen, right? And the classic example is positive feedback is when the guitar speakers start to scream, at a concert, right? Because it's a positive feedback loop that's pushing the speakers to go crazy. Anyway, positive feedback, and of course, positive feedback on the climate scale is when the tundra up in Alaska all melt, release more greenhouse gases, which melts more tundra, which releases more greenhouse gases, which makes everything warmer, which melts more tundra, which releases more greenhouse gas. You can see it's a self-intensifying cycle. Another word, theory. The public meaning of theory is a speculation, right? Sort of a hunch that maybe, you know, my theory is, but in the scientific world, theory is, you know, what you understand to be true or the way something works. It's much more than a hunch. In the word uncertainty, publicly, people think it means you're ignorant, right? You don't know because you're uncertain about something. Whereas the scientific meaning of uncertainty is the range of possible values that might truly be the right one. So a small uncertainty means you're getting close to the actual value of something, like what's the temperature going to be in 20 years, right? Same thing with error, right? When most people hear the word error, they think of a mistake, whereas in a scientific perspective, the error on a measurement is sort of how far away your actual measurement is from what is metaphysically the correct number, right? So you want that the quote-unquote error to be small, right, because that means you're closing in on the true number. But it's not like you're mistaken. It's just a term to describe scientifically that you know your measurement probably is not the exact true number, but it's pretty close. And how close is it? Well, it's the error measurement. Oh, there's a whole bunch of other words, right? There's bias, which is, if you say bias, most people that think of, you know, political distortion, right? Bias, whereas in scientific words, a bias is basically some kind of an offset, you know, a fixed amount offset from your observation. That your observations are biased by 10% because, you know, you were looking at the gauge the wrong way. Lots of other words around. When scientists say they manipulate data, it means they are processing it. They are working on it, right? They're using it to get the right answer, whereas when most people hear the word manipulation, they think someone's screwing around. It's illicit tampering. Right? That's not what scientists mean. Manipulation of the data means you're using it, adding it up, dividing it, subtracting it, figuring out what's going on, and that's different. So anyway, there you go. There's lots of interesting words that are different between the way the public uses them and the way the scientists use them. And it's useful to have that in your back pocket when you see scientists making statements in the newspaper. Okay? So there you go. What we'll do is put up links to what we can from this conversation. The links will be on the Mass Climate Action Network website. You can go in, you look for massclimateaction.org. Look on the banner for newsletter and more. Pull down the blog and podcast, and there you'll find the hot links to this podcast. If you have questions or comments, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we ought to be talking about. Hopefully you're listening to this on your smartphone using one of the modern podcast distribution apps, or on all of them. Please ask your friends to listen to us on their favorite modern podcast distribution app. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. I want to close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's a patriotic duty of citizens to speak out, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. There you go. Thanks for listening. Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.